This week marks the 30th anniversary of our program. We went on the air on the third day of May in 1971. Now 534 public radio stations carry All Things Considered. The program's also available overseas and on the Internet. We wanted to pause a bit to reflect on those 30 years and to gather information for three reports this week. We've been doing some traveling.
The national issue in May of 1971 was the Vietnam War. There was a large demonstration here in Washington on our very first day of broadcast. But the civil rights struggle that deeply intensified during the early 1960s was still in the news. In April of 71, the Supreme Court voted to uphold the use of busing as a way of integrating schools. Over the years, against the changes brought by civil rights legislation, the state of Mississippi stood sometimes alone, always defiant, and often angry and violent. Just last month, in a referendum, Mississippi voters rejected overwhelmingly a move to change the state flag. I spent a week in Mississippi, just traveling and talking with people, about the old days and the new. I especially wanted to see how much the state was paying attention to its past, as well as looking to the future.
I'm Rachel Pierce. I'm 25 years old. I'm from Aberdeen, Mississippi. I'm a third-year law student here at the university, and I've accepted a job with a law firm in Tupelo, Mississippi. Certainly what I can say from my own personal view is that what I want to do is what's best for Mississippi. In my mind, it's the greatest place on earth to live, and I've been given such a great gift by living here.
I stopped in the town of Oxford to meet some law students at the University of Mississippi. The school is nicknamed Old Miss. It's an echo of the years of slavery. The daughter of a plantation owner would be known as Young Missy, and her mother as Old Missy. Back in 1962, a young man named James Meredith brought the university into direct confrontation with the Kennedy administration.
Mr. James Meredith is now in residence.
The students have calmed down some. The deaths of two people have sobered them up.
It must be 1 o'clock at night that there were 150 state police.
Rocks, broken bottles, canisters that had contained the tear gas shells were strewn about everywhere.
Mr. Meredith was a sophomore at Jackson State. He wanted to transfer to the university. In his letter of application, he said, "I will not be able to furnish you with the names of 6 university alumni because I am a Negro and all graduates of the school are white." The Supreme Court had ruled 8 years earlier that school desegregation would be the law of the land. Mississippi refused. And that's why on the Oxford campus, protesters fought against federal marshals and troops. Chris Walker is an Ole Miss law student. He was born in Kosciuszko, which was also the hometown of James Meredith.
It was always strange to me that I actually didn't know that he was from Kosciuszko for a long time because they didn't tell us that. At home, it's kind of a factor if our parents didn't tell you, then they weren't going to teach it in the school system. They weren't going to tell you all about it. It seemed like it was kind of something they don't want to relive or something they don't want you to know about. Even all the things that happened here, I didn't really know about, you know, people being killed and all the demonstrations until I go. If you go to other states, you can hear more about it in their textbooks than you'll hear about it here in Mississippi.
I think it is hard for us to even fathom that idea because 62 was so long ago. You know, I wasn't born until 1976. When I started, you know, elementary school, I started Arlington Elementary. That was practically 50%. Continued at junior high school and public schools where that just wasn't an issue. And then, you know, now that I'm at Ole Miss, it's the same thing for me. And so I think it is hard for our generation to grasp what happened because now we stand, you know, as a state so strong and we still do have problems, but it's certainly not unique to Mississippi, but, you know, rather a national thing that we still deal with.
University of Mississippi law students Julie Gerald, Chris Walker, and earlier Rachel Pierce. You might still hear Dixie at an Ole Miss football game. But university officials did speak out in favor of removing the Confederate imagery from the Mississippi state flag. And the school has now raised almost all the money it needs to build a civil rights memorial on the campus at Oxford. Outside Starkville, Mississippi, I was welcomed by a retired state senator named Horace Harned. He has a dairy farm on his family's old plantation land. Mr. Harned is 80 years old, and he says he doesn't often get a chance to explain his side of the civil rights story to the state's young people.
There are very few that are that much interested in the subject to really pursue it and concentrate on it. If they are, I'd be glad to sit down and try to explain. I've got nothing to hide.
We talked in his living room, watched over by portraits of his forebears. Senator Harned has worked all his life to protect Mississippi from, as he would put it, the threat of integration. Among his fears, a communist takeover, even a black republic. He and his wife and his mother joined the White Citizens Councils, which were started after the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling. The councils, in effect, ran the state. He was also a member of the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. It was a spy agency, paid for with tax money and given the power of law enforcement.
Now, I'll say this. We had spies that were spying into the civil rights movement when the marches came through here because they had openly threatened to burn down the courthouse at Grenada and at Canton and one or two others.
It was a nonviolent movement.
No, it wasn't nonviolent in New Jersey and Chicago and Watts. Not at all.
But not in Mississippi?
No, they didn't in Mississippi because Mississippi got control of the situation. And when the civil rights, a lot of them, marches rode in, if they violated the law, they were locked up and sent to penitentiary. They'd send hundreds of them up to penitentiary. And it soon broke that thing up.
In 1964, a paid informant furnished the license plate number of a car to the Sovereignty Commission, and then that information was disseminated to the sheriff's offices in the counties in the state. Mm-hmm. That turned out to be the license plate number of the car in which the three young civil rights workers were shot in Neshoba County. Mm-hmm. They were killed.
Well, of course, I was not aware of that at the time, and we wouldn't have agreed to that sort of thing. I wouldn't have.
Not to the outcome, but
no.
But if you start here,
yeah,
you can wind up here.
Well, you see what has happened. That at this point in time, the House Committee on Un-American Activities has been dissolved, and the communists were so strong. So we had to do what we could to protect ourselves, and I'm sorry that some things happened as they did. Innocent people get killed in all wars today. And it's a shame. It'd be nice if we could be prevented, but when you're in all-out war, you're at war.
Former State Senator Horace Harned. The Mississippi Sovereignty Commission was disbanded in the 70s, but in 1989, some of its work became public with dramatic results. A newspaper, the Jackson Clarion Ledger, brought violence back to the front page. The headline said, "State checked possible jurors in Evers slaying." Medgar Evers was a civil rights leader who was shot in the back in the driveway of his Jackson home. Two all-white, all-male juries refused to convict the accused murderer, Byron De La Beckwith. Reporter Jerry Mitchell learned that the Sovereignty Commission had investigated the potential jurors for the benefit of the defense.
There are so many times as reporters, I mean, 99.9% of the stories you do, they don't have any impact, or you feel like they don't have any impact, but it's one of those cases where it did have an impact and it gathered momentum and all these things began to happen. And today, because of the Evers case, there have now been 19 killings from the civil rights era that have been reinvestigated since 1989.
Byron De La Beckwith was retried, given a life sentence, and died this past January. The remaining Sovereignty Commission files have now been made public. They've been scanned into a computer at the State Archives, and soon they'll even be on the Internet. 132,000 pages, artifacts of another era.
Here is a November 1965 report of the investigator Andy Hopkins.
Rims Barber, a Presbyterian minister and a civil rights movement veteran, reads one of his entries from the commission's files.
A few days ago, Reverend Barber is alleged to have created a disturbance in the sheriff's office in Canton by placing a young Negro man at the head of a line of people who were waiting to buy automobile license plates. According to information from the sheriff's office, Reverend Barber is alleged to have used abusive and profane language to the deputy sheriff, for which he was arrested, placed in jail, and later released on bond. Blah, blah, blah.
And were you indeed bringing a black applicant from the back of the line to the front?
This guy had been pushed to the back of the line wrongfully, and I suggested that he had a place that he originally was in was where he ought to be.
Rems Barber reading from a Sovereignty Commission file. Reverend Barber told me that the white establishment back then always got one thing wrong. They didn't believe that local blacks could figure out the civil rights movement for themselves. One morning I drove into the Delta farmland of northwest Mississippi, the flat, dark, rich cotton and soybean fields. If you go to the Delta looking for touchstones of the past, looking for today's story of how that past is being recognized or not, stop in the town of Cleveland and sit on the couch with Margaret Block. The pictures on her walls are of civil rights leaders, including Fannie Lou Hamer. Margaret Block grew up as an activist and helped with the early efforts to register black voters.
First, I started trying to help people to read. It was a literacy class and teach them how, because I didn't understand the process of registering down here either. I know people with PhDs that couldn't pass that test because it was at the whim of the circuit clerk to administer the test to you.
You must have felt it was just totally frustrating to try to register people to vote. I
mean, oh, it was extremely frustrating.
Would you even go driving around these counties in the Delta at night in the early 60s?
No, I wouldn't. Not unless I was with a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't. I still have flashbacks. I was going out to one of my friend's house one night and looked in my rearview mirror and saw this big pickup truck. People drive big pickup trucks down here, but I had a flashback. I panicked. I almost had a wreck.
That was almost like somebody who'd been in Vietnam coming back years later.
Yeah, I didn't talk about it for years. I didn't teach my kids about the movement. I just didn't talk about it. I blocked it out.
But don't you see it as a struggle that was won? Don't you see great victories there?
I see victories, but not great, because the struggle is not over with yet. Look at what happened in Florida. I'm not talking about the votes that the recount. I'm talking about the ones that wasn't allowed to vote at all. Do you know how devastating that is for somebody that's been through the struggles that we've been through, for them to turn around in the 21st century and do the same thing that they were doing in 1964, denying people the right to vote? You know, that's why I'm going, we need to start preserving stuff.
Margaret Block is trying to establish a memorial in her town of Cleveland. She wants to save a house, and she takes me to see it.
Yeah, this is the house. It's a brick house, and it's trimmed in orange. It was the first brick house built in Cleveland by a black man.
They called it the Freedom House. It belonged to Amzi Moore. He'd been overseas in World War II, worked as a janitor in the local post office, sang in a gospel quartet, and began his organizing for the NAACP in the late 1940s. It was Amzi Moore's idea that activists from other states should help out in the Mississippi Delta.
It's important that we save this house. If Robert F. Kennedy was in this house, Bob Moses, John Lewis, Wazir Peacock. It's a wonder they didn't bomb that house.
This is a project that's looking at the past in order to move forward. It's not just looking at the past in order to stare at it and to revel in it and to just stay there. This is not about nostalgia necessarily.
A meeting of the Historical Society in Atala County, Mississippi.
So tell me about your project.
Well, Shana, we have selected 55 people to be interviewed.
The state legislature now provides money for an oral history project. Shauna Walton travels out from Mississippi Southern University to explain about tape recorders and release forms. After the meeting, I talk with two of the society's members, Ellen Pettit and Catherine Carr Esters.
I am the great-great-granddaughter of slaves. In this county, we looked to the public like we were just fine, but we were not. Our people were complacent and accepted the worst thing that ever happened to any of us that we didn't talk about was Jim Crow. And part of my story will tell that in detail, how it affected my generation of folk.
Well, I don't have a lot to say about the civil rights movement because as a Christian, I've never mistreated. I've seen people mistreated, and I certainly wouldn't go along with it. I would like to say that I'm happy to see the things that have happened since the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't have had an authentic oral history project 30 years ago. There would have been too much tension to ask people, right. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm. May I say one
yes,
other thing?
Yes, certainly.
Ellen, I want to say this to you. If there's anybody that I truly love, however, when she addressed my mother, she always called my mother by her name, her first name. I was taught to address her mother and say Mrs. That bothered me. In 1972, I came back here, and I had money on deposit in the Citizens Bank for my mother, and every month when we'd get the statement, they just have Ida L. Carr on there, no Mrs. ever. I walked into the bank one day and said to the president, I'd like you to put Mrs. on the address plate, and he said, we don't do that. And I walked up the street to another bank, and that bank said, no, we've never addressed a black woman as Mrs. But I tell you what we will do. If you're going to deposit $5,000, we'll call your mother Mrs. and your father Mr. And we still bank with that bank.
I ended my Mississippi week in Jackson, still with questions about what the state might be doing to understand its past. And I learned about a civil rights driving tour. It's brand new this spring. 55 places have been identified. You can see the house where Medgar Evers was shot, the bus station where the Freedom Riders arrived, and on Farish Street downtown, a boarded-up restaurant that once was a gathering place for the movement.
When I first came to this intersection, I was probably about 15 or 16.
And what were these businesses like up and down this street?
To me, it was amazing to see, you know, such businesses being owned, operated, and run by black people.
Hollis Watkins is showing me this neighborhood. Mr. Watkins runs an organization called Southern Echo, working with young people statewide. He still sees racism and fear among both blacks and whites, but he believes that's changing in Mississippi.
I talk to a lot of white people at different times, you know, and especially some of the young people, and they tell me, says, well, you know, don't blame me for what my grandparents and great, and I tell them, I don't blame you not one iota for what your parent, your grandparents, great-grandparent did, because that was them. And you should not be held accountable or blamed for that. But I say to them, it is one thing, though, I will say, that if you're serious about carrying this state and this country to another level, you have to admit the wrong that they did. And you have to be willing to help me, who also know that these wrong things happen. You have to be willing to help and assist me in correcting these wrongs.
Hollis Watkins was 19 when he was arrested at a Woolworths lunch counter. He was 21 when he and other protesters spent 58 days in the Parchman Penitentiary, sometimes hanging by their handcuffs from the cell doors. Mr. Watkins, then as now, was known for his fine tenor voice. and he offers a song in parting.
As we would say back during the 60s, and we still do it now, you know, we say to the folks as a part of overcoming fear, which we did in the 60s, we sang that song of Ain't Scared of Nobody Cause I Want My Freedom. You never heard that song?
No.
Let me tell you how it goes real good. Ain't scared of nobody cause I want my freedom. I want my freedom. I want my freedom. Ain't scared of nobody cause I want my freedom. I want my freedom now. I speak the truth cause I want my freedom. I want my freedom. I want my freedom. I'll speak the truth cause I want my freedom. I want my freedom now. We sang that then. We sang it now. Young folks loves it.
In Mississippi, there are two things that people like to tell you. One is, Mississippi now leads the nation in black elected officials. The other is, and you can complete this sentence yourself, some of my best friends are, and quite often, they're very sincere. The Mississippi-born writer and editor, Willie Morris, not long before he died in 1999, wrote this about his state. Mississippians watch the same television as other Americans, frequent the same shopping malls, and live in the same kinds of suburbias. At the new century, it is the juxtapositions of Mississippi, emotional and in remembrance, and the tensions of its paradoxes that still drive us crazy. Thank you.